Bauhaus, Viceland, fresh off the boats, Eddie Wong, in the house, sort of, on a Meal Amux takeout. And hello, dear listener, all one of you at a time. Unless you're simultaneously listening, you're not all listening at once. It's one at a time. That's the beauty of podcasting. Welcome to what I call a Meal Amux takeout. We serve it, you take it out. It forms the acronym EAT, E-A-T, and it is time to eat. My takes on all things about race, society, politics, and diversity, and everything those things touch in our culture and society with respect to Asian Americans. And of course, you don't have to be Asian American to lend us your ears. We're all in this thing together. Besides, it's your minds we want. I'm Emil Guillermo, your host, and you might say, why Amok? Well, the short story is that for nearly 15 years, my Emil Amok column was a staple of Asian Week, what was once the leading Asian American weekly in English. In America, Amok was the name of my compilation of essays, and Amok is on my driver's license, not indicative of my mental state. Of course, most of what you hear is based on my column, which appears on the website of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund blog. It's at ALDEF, ALDEF.org/blog. Check it out, and if you like what you see and hear, ALDEF is a 501c3. Go to the donate button. It's tax deductible. Now, on this edition, as I said, Eddie Wong, the guy who wrote the memoir Fresh Off the Boat, from which the sitcom is based on, I say based on, Eddie is still, I believe, a producer on the show, but it's based on the book, and you know what that means. It means that it's sort of the relationship of, say, cheese to Cheese Whiz. And of course, if you're lactose intolerant, then all bets are off. But Eddie Wong was at the AAJA convention, and I'm here in Philadelphia at the AAJA convention. I've been to, oh my goodness, more than 20 of these. And I left with a good feeling here. And mind you, a couple years ago, I won a bunch of awards, and I had a good feeling at that convention. But I really had a good feeling at this one because there was some real substance, and I was part of the Story Slam, the first ever at AAJA, which is, I think, a real departure and a nice departure because sometimes, you know, when technology is changing the industry, it's kind of nice when you come to realize that all you need is a person with a story in front of an audience and telling that story from the heart. And that really is the very basis of what we do as journalists. We're truth tellers, speaking from the heart. So that's what the Story Slam is about. I shared the stage with six really great storytellers and journalists, and it was a competition, but everyone won, really. I mean, because it was a full crowd, about, the room was full, about 200 or so in the room, and it was just a great event, and I hope we do more of it, the Story Slam. At AAJA. In fact, I thought maybe we should just have an open mic in the same way they have karaoke nights. Maybe we should have an open mic night where people can do a 3-minute story and talk. In essence, a public square where people can spout off. It could be a story, could be jokes, could be singing. I don't know. But I think it's kind of like an open mic is a symbol of the First Amendment, which is something a journalist organization should really embrace. And so that's what the Story Slam meant to me, and it was a good event. But really, the capper came at the final banquet. Because the capper, the showstopper, was Eddie Wong. And if you're not familiar with Eddie, well, I mentioned Fresh Off the Boat. That was his memoir. Interesting, he said that when he first wanted to write, because he created Bauhaus down there in New York, everyone, the publishers, wanted a cookbook, not a memoir. And Eddie essentially said, screw it, I'm going to write a memoir. And the memoir became really, I think, for this generation. Because, you know, there were Asian writers previously. But, you know, for... And Eddie says this in the interview that we'll play, that at the time he wrote in around 2009, there was the whole Tiger Mom business coming out, and he was angry because he felt that here was someone, you know, from our own ilk who was putting the proverbial Jimmy Choo on our neck, and. And he felt he had the need to tell his story. So he says it much better than that during the interview. He did an interview with Kat Chow at the final, at the big awards banquet at the convention. And it's just one of many of the gems that he came up with. I mean, first of all, Eddie was looking very resplendent in what appeared to be a caftan. It's sultry weather here in Philadelphia. But a caftan was something I didn't exactly expect, but it was very cool, and he was very cool. Kat Chow of NPR interviewed him, and I guess that's a new way. Instead of keynote speeches, people do that sort of thing now, and it's very relaxed, very informal. We'll play it for you. But once again, I just thought he made some excellent points, especially about the intersectionality and the commonality that Asian Americans have with other groups. In fact, he said it was his experience with the black community and his experience with hip-hop, the hip-hop community, and basketball. That was what brought him out of his shell, and that also gave him the encouragement to come out. And I have to second that, because this is a story I tell. I mean, I went to Harvard and had my literary ambitions, and I applied for a poetry class given by one of the top 20th century poets, female poets. Elizabeth Bishop was giving a class at Harvard, and I applied, and you know, she turned me down. If you know something about Elizabeth Bishop's background, you know, she probably turned me down for other reasons. But still, it was like, I'm an Asian face and I didn't belong there. But where did I turn to, and where did I seek refuge, and who accepted me? The Afro-American Studies Department and a poet there, Andrea Rushing, who was teaching there at the time. And she accepted me in her class, and that really was the literary basis for me from you know, those days in college. And I'll never forget that. I mean, it has always been the black experience. Other people who realize what Asian Americans are going through. I mean, this happened time and time again. Even before then, I ran into the publisher of Essence magazine, Ida Lewis, and she was very helpful to me. And then ultimately in graduate school, the great writer and social critic Ishmael Reed was one of my teachers. And when another heralded famous white teacher told me to take out the Filipino characters in my fiction, here was Ishmael telling me, stick those Filipinos back in. So, boy, when I heard Eddie say that at the dinner, I said, of course. This is just the next generation of what I experienced previously. And it made total sense. So anyway, Eddie Wong, interviewed by Kat Chow of NPR at the Asian American Journalists Association, its national convention in Philadelphia. It was the capper, the highlight, the keynote interview, or the keynote moment of the convention. And here it is.
Hello, how's everybody doing this evening?
You guys excited for this?
Yo, I'm excited. I want to take 1 second and congratulate everybody that won for their projects this year. It's very inspiring to see the work Asian American journalists are doing, not just for our community, but other communities as well. So, congrats.
And Eddie, you mentioned that you got to spend some time at this conference. Have you been enjoying it so far?
Yeah, no, I'm on the record. This is my favorite conference I've been to. And I've told people, like one-on-one, why this has been my favorite conference. I was infamously kicked out of TED for not going to the conference. but no, this one is incredible because it's diverse, it's multicultural, it is about Asian American issues, but it's also about the work we do inside, outside of this community, intersectionality and solidarity.
And I think that for a lot of people, and I'll speak for myself actually, a lot of Asian Americans too, your work has really resonated with us, and well, with me in particular. You write about your experience as an Asian American in a way that is so resonant. I mean, your books, your memoirs, Fresh Off the Boat, which a lot of you are familiar with, and Double Cup Love. I was wondering, can you bring us back to that moment when you thought, you know what, I'm gonna write about my life? Because in an interview that you recently did with Stretch and Bob, an NPR podcast that's coming out soon, you said that you felt like you couldn't feel comfortable with yourself until you started telling your story. And that was so resonant. Like, why did you decide to do it?
Yeah, I didn't even know how therapeutic it was going to be to write the story. And I will tell you guys the feeling I had the day I finished the book, and then go back to the idea, if you don't mind. Is I remember the day I finished the book, it was about like 2 a.m. on a weekday night, and I looked at the computer screen, took a photo, and sent it to my middle brother, because me and my middle brother lived through some really tough times in my family. And I sent it to him and I said, yo, I want you to have this copy. I want you to have the manuscript, because no matter what happens, we did this. And I remember waking up the next morning, and when we were kids, if it was a weekday morning, my mom was on the intercom yelling at us, wake up, get ready, get your homework, put your shoes on, get in the car. And then on the weekend, it was like, wake up, you gotta pressure wash the house. My dad was yelling. And it was like, we just had lists of things, and it felt like we were ever gonna finish everything. We were never gonna make our parents happy. And I remember waking up the day after I wrote Fresh Off the Boat, sent it to my brother, and I laid in bed on First Avenue and 14th Street, and I said to myself, my mom can't tell me to do shit today. And it was very therapeutic to feel like I did something with my life. And even though I didn't turn out to be a doctor, and I was only a lawyer for 6 months, it was, you know, that broke her heart. I was like, I accomplished something, something I'm proud of. And, you know, there's a lot of journalists here working in a lot of industries. When I was coming around in 2009, the reason why I did Bauhaus was because people didn't necessarily want to hear about our issues. Like, they kind of laughed at me that I was an Asian that wanted to write screenplays or write books. And even after Bauhaus took off, publishers came to find me, agents came to find me, but they all wanted a cookbook. They wanted the Bauhaus cookbook, and I told them, I want to write a memoir. And they said, that's funny. And a couple of the agents were like, well, if you change your mind and want to write a cookbook, let us know.
So you had to fight really hard just to tell your story. Can you kind of talk about what those conversations were like with publishers and agents trying to tell the story that you specifically wanted to tell?
Yeah, like our Asian identity and the narrative of our community was so pigeonholed and siloed in 2009. And something I don't know if people remember, but I was trying to sell Fresh Off the Boat in the shadow of Amy Chua, Tiger Mom. Like, Tiger Mom had just come out, and I remember reading Tiger Mom and seeing the news, and I was like, I've always been anxious and frustrated with how we're represented. But to have someone from the community of our same ilk put that foot on our neck and like drive the stake through our hearts even more about this model minority myth drove me crazy. It drove me crazy. And I just want to share the story that it was people from other communities that saw solidarity and found commonality with my story, our story, that made it happen, because it was a Jewish agent, Mark Gerald, who represented, his first client was Miss Cleo from BET. She would like tell people's fortunes and stuff. Like, I love Miss Cleo, so I was like, oh, word, you got clients. And, you know, he represented all the Cash Money books, and he represented 50 Cent, and these were people I looked up to. And then, you know, so Mark was the one that said, I believe in you. You know, like, you don't have to write a cookbook, let's do this. And then I sent him 60 pages. I wrote 60 pages over 2 days, sent it to him, and he said, wow, like, you have a book here, but this is like a mixtape. Like, we're trying to sell an album. And he said, I'm gonna put you with RZA's editor, who helped RZA write his book, because y'all will relate. And I was, you know, I always found solidarity with Black culture, because I feel like Black Americans have done so much to pave the way for human rights in this country for everybody, not just Black Americans, not just Asian Americans, but humans in general in America. Like,
so, you've put so much of your personal life out there, I mean, and also you've kind of gained this role as cultural critic. I don't know if you see yourself as that, but I think a lot of Asian Americans do. And your life has kind of become really public. How do you reconcile that, the fact that your life is out there? I mean, then like what you tweet really matters.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I was just talking to my girlfriend Julie about it yesterday, and she's like, I don't feel like there's anything about you that's private. And I realized, yeah, that it is a weird feeling, and it's tough sometimes, but I made a conscious decision in 2009 to do this, because I said, so many of us are taught to be invisible in this world, in this nation, just put our head down, be model minorities, be career focused, be upwardly mobile. And I said, you know what, I will give my story. I will reveal my pain, my struggle, my wins and losses, shouts to Meek Mill, we in Philly. I would give that up if that means that it would make people more interested in Asian America and our stories. So I think I've put it all out there. My next book is fiction. I'm working more in the fiction realm, because—
Can you say more about that?
Yeah, it's a book that really explores existentialism through boxing, right? I feel like that Wesley Yang, one of my favorite writers, he wrote Paper Tigers, very, very accomplished journalist. He came to me after I wrote Fresh Off the Boat, and he was interviewing me for the New York Times. He said, I feel like Fresh Off the Boat is a story about violence in Asian America. And I said, absolutely. That's what I thought. That's what Chris Jackson thought. I'm really glad you see it. And it was violent in my home. And I've always grappled and tried to untangle this violence. And I feel that violence is all around the world, even if the powers that be try to tell us that it's been removed or that it's criminal. But politics is violent. The market is violent. Relationships can be violent. Emotions, things you say. So boxing's been very interesting for me as an outlet to exercise violence and understand my personal relationship to it. Because I think as a society, we have to remember, like, we're animals. And even if we can't punch each other, not that I think we should, it's good we can't punch each other and we can't be violent towards each other, but those urges manifest themselves in other pockets of society, and we have to be aware of it.
So I was talking to a mentor about fiction, and she said that she feels like with fiction, sometimes people are able to speak more truth than in nonfiction. How has writing this novel kind of changed you?
Well, you know, to talk shop for a second, because we were journalists, so it's all right to talk shop. When you write memoir, the plot line is there. You know, like you can attack it like Christopher Nolan and tell it in reverse, find different entry points, you could Dunkirk it. But, you know, when it's fiction, the plot line, you have to create that. You have to create all the moments. And sometimes, I think my weakness as a writer is that I can be slightly allegorical. I take detours from the narrative to like be an essayist for multiple pages at a time. I think that's my biggest weakness. I try to break that. And so this time I'm really creating characters. I know the themes in my head and I'm writing scenes. I like to write scene work. And then once I have 200, 250 pages, then I'll start to like move the pieces around and string the story together. And you know, the guy I look up to is Juno Diaz. I think Juno's the most
he's one of my favorites.
Yeah, he's the most powerful Jedi in the universe. Yeah, and I just always, I go back and read Oscar Wilde, because like writers, when you write, you're putting a lot of lines in the water. And Oscar Wilde to me, outside of like Shakespeare, not to be a dork, but like that's the one book, is Juno, is every single line that Juno put in the water, he caught a fish. Like that last page of Oscar Wilde, every single line comes home. There's a fish on every hook, and I'm like, goddamn. Like, I love that there is a Jedi that powerful, so that there's always something to work towards, you know?
Yeah. To switch gears a little bit, and this question comes from an AAJA member, Tom Wong. He, when we were talking about things that people were really curious about, he mentioned this question, which is, how do you think that the image of Asian American men has shifted? And do you feel like maybe you've kind of contributed to that shift?
Well, I would hope that I contributed in a positive way, because I have tried, you know? And I've tried, I've given up a lot of myself, whether it's shooting like underwear campaigns and talking about Asian masculinity.
Are we gonna put that picture up there?
You know, it was very, very important to me, and it was my cousin that brought my attention to the emasculation of Asian males, because we were watching Romeo Must Die, and he's like, yo, Jet Li like saves Aaliyah, like, and you know, they don't do it. And then, you know, Chow Yun-Fat saves Mira Sorvino, replacement killers, and it's like, it's a handshake. And he's like, if this was James Bond, he would already smashed off before he met these Johns. And respect to all the women, this is just verbatim from him. That's not like the goal, that's not the goal of narratives, is to smash off. But, you know, I said, that is very interesting. That's very interesting that in this patriarchal world, like, there's a double standard, and that, you know, I went back and read the history, and I said, this is interesting, because during Yellow Peril, we were stereotyped as these ultra-horny Chinese gold miners just tearing up brothels and smashing like rabbits, and then all of a sudden in the 60s, during the rise of the Black Panthers, during Vietnam, it was like they fractured a human being, and they said, all right, these character traits we're going to put in the Black community, these character traits we'll put in the Latino community, and these character traits we will put in the Asian community.
Yeah.
And it really felt like none of us were allowed to be whole human beings. And I'm upset about it to this day. And I think that everything I do is to try and regain that value, regain that identity as a whole human being. Because I think the saddest thing about being a person of color in this country is that you don't even know what you could have been in the motherland.
So speaking of that.
Can I finish one second? I'm sorry. I love this time. Is that when you go back to the motherland, you see, wait, there's cab drivers, there's doctors, there's basketball players, there's everything. There's cats on rollerblades and skateboards, like any mode of transportation. But in America, you're fractured. And you don't even know what the Matrix has put in your head. Like, there's preloaded software on your identity that you have no connection to. Somebody else put that there. And I don't know if we will ever be able to know what it's like without that, but I think all we can be is aware of it. You know, like what other people put there and what I've put there myself.
So for your second book, Double Cup Love, you actually do go back to the motherland, as you just put it. And I was really struck by the sense that, to me, when I read that book, I felt like it was a book about where you're trying to address the question, am I Chinese enough, or how Chinese am I, right? And that was such a compelling question to me, because I think that's something that I have wondered myself, my sisters have wondered ourselves, and a lot of people here who are Asian American have probably wondered also. How did you go about addressing that question, and like, what did you find?
It's a really heartbreaking question to ask, and it's like in the back of your head all the time, because, you know, even when I go to Chinatown and I buy groceries and I say, oh, 你们有没有空心菜? And the ladies always like giggle with the hand over the mouth and said, oh, his accent is so funny. And I'm like, is it that bad? And they're like, no, it's funny to see a full grown man that talks like an 8-year-old child. They're like, you just sound like an 8-year-old Taiwanese kid.
Yeah.
And so it's really weird to have your growth and identity stunted like that. But when I went back, what I realized is that, like, our brothers and sisters out there, if we are open-hearted enough to go listen to them, they're so excited to have us back home. They're so excited to reconnect with us and to bridge, you know, the pain of the Cultural Revolution. You know, like, everything was cut off. And I meet a lot of Chinese chefs. Master Yu, right, he said to me, he said, you are Chinese, and it's very important that you're Chinese and you own this, because even in China, there's a lot of cooks that don't value the knowledge and the old recipes that I pass on to them. You know, China's economy is scaling so much. He said, even the quality of tea, I can't find tea that will unravel as a whole leaf, right? The best tea is tea that when you boil it, not boil, but like around 200 degrees, and the tea comes out and it's one whole leaf and it's glossy and it's almost like a pecking duck skin. And he would show me the tea, he said, your brothers and sisters make this the right way in Taiwan. You know, Gao San Cha, you know, a high mountain oolong tea. And I was like, I can't take credit, dog. I was born in DC, you know, but respect. And then he said, it's important because we lost so much during the Cultural Revolution. Like, so many books were burned and things were shattered and these statues of Confucius were broken. And he said, it journeyed to Taiwan. But then so many Weissenrin, like overseas Chinese, went from Taiwan to America and Cuba and the Dominican Republic. And he said, it's important for us to keep this alive and keep the connection together. So in an American sense, I always thought, oh, I wasn't Chinese enough. But when I went back, I realized we are, like, you're Korean enough, you're Chinese enough. I met Korean adoptees that go back to Korea to reconnect. And you know, we are connected forever, and even outside of your own particular race, we are human beings. You know, like, at the end of the day, we share so much genetic material that Jamaica says it best, out of many, one people, you know?
Yeah. That's right. So, how do you see your identity now, though? I mean, you kind of talked about touched on that, but can you sort of parse out, I mean, are you more Chinese American, are you Asian American, like, how do you reconcile all of these different parts of yourself?
I really am trying to get beyond race as this umbrella that, like, keeps me underneath, you know, and I am so proud of the Chinese culture that my parents raised me on, but I'm also very proud of, like, the hip-hop culture or the basketball culture that has informed so much of my life and I'm connected to and I owe so much to. And, you know, for a long time, I worried, you know, is this weird that I connect so much to hip-hop in African-American culture. And then I realized, no, it's not weird, because this is a human art form, and it's so powerful. It's the most undeniable, hip-hop is the most undeniable cultural force of the last 30 years. You know, it absolutely is. And so it should surprise nobody that I connected or anybody connected to it. And RIP Prodigy, you know, he was a really close friend of mine, but when Prodigy passed, I wrote this New York Times article to try to talk about how much P meant to me and everybody beyond just the hip hop community. And, you know, I said, if I said that I was influenced by Shakespeare or Socrates or Aristotle, no one would trip. No one would be like, oh, that's weird because you're Chinese and they're from like the 5th century, you know? But if I say I'm influenced in hip hop, then I have to explain why, and there has to be this like origin story. But I said, that's because there is a bias and discrimination towards black culture and art forms. This is just human cultural work that should be respected and understood on its own two feet. And I really am trying to see race culturally. I want people to learn Chinese philosophy, take things from Chinese food, learn about it, respect it, and then not take it and create something else in a different community, but like to give back to it and become part of our community. You know, just like I've become part of the hip hop community or the basketball community, like Rich has become part of, you know? And I think we all have to transcend the like shackles that race has on us, not to say post-racial, because that's not what I'm talking about, but I'm talking about allowing yourself to be multifaceted, allowing yourself to be a part of this global community, but know that you're rooted in a native culture and to never let that go.
Really quickly, last question. Say it's your last meal. What do you eat and who do you eat it with?
Yeah. Oh man. Last meal, soup dumplings. Yeah. Absolutely. Soup dumplings on Yongkangjie in Taiwan. And if I get to pick anybody dead or alive, it's my grandparents who passed, my parents, my brothers, my girlfriend Julie, and my best friend Rafael Martinez and Elena Bergeron. Like, you know, family first. Family first.
Thank you so much. Thank you. See you at karaoke.
Oh, I'm down for karaoke. I hope you got, you know, if they don't got it, please cue up the Dipset anthem, because that's my joint. Yes, thank you. Thank you, AJ.
And that was Eddie Wong, the author of Fresh Off the Boat, the book from which the sitcom is based on. He's also the creator of the Bauhaus restaurants in New York and L.A., Viceland TV show coming out. Eddie Wong, really, he was even better live than I thought. And I always wondered, you know, if we were getting, if Fresh Off the Boat, the TV show, was the taming of Eddie Wong. Well, we got the unbridled Eddie Wong, or the cooler unbridled Eddie Wong, at the AAJA dinner. And it was great to see him there, and hopefully an inspiration, not just to all Asian Americans who have a story to tell. And I know that this is true, because even during the story slam, when I told the story of how my cousin Stefan was shot and killed and how justice was elusive, people came up to me afterwards who were touched by the story, especially one Asian American woman who had her own story to tell. So I know that as we tell these stories, we will inspire others, and they will come out of their shell and they will tell their stories. And ultimately, this sense of invisibility, this sense of Asian American docility, will vanish, and in its place will be one strong, solid Asian American community, right? Acknowledged among all in this great diverse nation of ours. Well, at least that's the hope, right? That's the hope. And for now, that's our program. From here in our Philadelphia hotel room. Hey, you know, we're on iTunes. Please subscribe, rate, and review, if you will. Tell your friends about the show, Emil Amuck Takeout. Share a link. You can contact me on Twitter, at Emil Amuck, or go to the Aldef blog at www.aldef.org/blog. Give us your feedback. Go to www.amok.com, amuck.com. That's my personal website. You can even leave a message there on SpeakPipe. You don't need a phone. If it's audible, we'll use it, just like talk radio. It's SpeakPipe. Just go to the site. You'll see it. It's there on the side. Hey, if you like what we do, share a link. Tell a friend. Go to the Aldef blog and hit the donate button if you're so moved. Aldef, A-A-L-D-E-F. The Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, aldef.org/blog. Aldef is a 501c3, and your help is tax deductible. So once again, thanks for listening to Emil Amuck's Takeout. We're in Philadelphia and heading home to California. I'm Emil Guillermo.